A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
These sort of 70s ideas were very interesting to me about feminism. How do you pass in the world of feminism if you're a man, and how do you pass in the world of black maleness if you're a woman, a white woman? I just think it was such a marvelous period of deep confusion and energy.
Hi, I'm Raihan Salam, and this is the Vice Podcast Show. I'm joined today by Hilton Alls, a critic for the New York Review of Books, The New Yorker, and author of a new collection, White Girls. Hilton, thanks very much for joining me.
Thank you for that presentation.
My pleasure. Yeah. So, Hilton, I should mention that as I was reading your book, I was often on the subway, often in public, and there was something about having a book, the title of which, as a kind of colored man, a book titled White Girls, and then on this half, you see the word mesmerizing.
Yes.
There was something about this presentation that put me ill at ease. I wonder about the origin of the title.
Oh, you felt marked by the book. The title for the book came about one day when I was walking with a friend, and we started talking about the number of people I had written about. I said, oh, one day I'm just going to write a book called White Girls because there's so many of them that I've written about. But when I started to think about the title, there was a deeper resonance, a more autobiographical resonance started to bubble up. And that concerned the first piece in the book, which is called Triste Tropique and hasn't been published before. And it's about largely my relationship to a woman who's passed away but was the figure, really, the emotional figure, the white girl that appears a lot emotionally in the book. She's Latvian from New Jersey and my oldest friend, and I just adored her. And she, I don't think, identified with her whiteness in a way. I mean, most of her friends were men of color. And I just started to think about what it meant for that person to transgress in that way. And once I started thinking about her, the rest of the book started to fall into place because each of the characters, or white girls, if you will, had transgressed in similar ways, sometimes negatively and sometimes positively.
When I look at the cultural landscape of America and of New York now compared to what it was like when I was a child, one thing I...
Did you grow up here?
I did. I grew up in Brooklyn. And one thing I find is that the idea of a white girl as a particular kind of category,
right,
as something that has some kind of cultural valence, is a lot more meaningful now than it would have been before when the category was a kind of blank, a kind of absence. And I wonder if you've seen that too, if you feel as though it's a category that has some more richness and meaning now.
I think that I completely agree with you, and I think it's a wonderful observation that you're making. When I'm older, I think, than you, and I grew up in Brooklyn as well, and one of the ways in which White Girls as a title started to feel significant to me was because when I worked in fashion, they would always refer to the black models as the black girls, and I never understood what that meant. Would you then say white woman or Asian person? I mean, how would you make those distinctions? So when I was a kid, it was almost a sort of derogatory term to sort of minimize importance. But now that the world has changed and so many white girls are heads of the family, have demarginalized themselves through the workforce and various ways in which power has been accrued, I think it has a much more tense meaning and also more descriptive meaning about power. You are still female, so how much power do you have? But you are white, so you can pass in the larger world. That said, I don't think the book is about that so much as it's about the white person or white girl's marginalization and how sometimes that desire to pass into the larger world or the status quo can be a dangerous thing.
Because much of the theme of the book and many of the characters in the book are people who have a complicated relationship to that status of being a white girl, are not necessarily universally identified as such, yet who aspire to it. And that's what's so striking, because yes. You're talking about a position of marginality, of weakness, of kind of preciousness, of the idea of being placed on a pedestal.
Yes.
Yet it's something that these people, that some of the people you describe aspire to. So why would one who does not naturally, quote unquote, belong to that category, long for it and aspire to manifest it?
Well, because I think of the past perception that it was the next step up from being colored or male, for instance. I think that aspiration, I think people always aspire to the thing that they feel has more freedom or more privilege. And if you read people like Shulamith Firestone, who talks about the white woman's identification with black men, these sort of 70s ideas were very interesting to me about feminism and how do you pass in the world of feminism if you're a man, and how do you pass in the world of black maleness if you're a woman, a white woman. So I wanted to mix those genres up while using that idea that Shulamith Firestone had laid out in her book, and that Eldridge Cleaver indirectly attacks in his book, or actually attacks in his book. All of these ideas that I had actually grown up with as a kid because of my sisters who were politically involved, it was really important for me to sort of try to sort of extricate or at least kind of go deeper into those ideas about identification and mirroring. How do you become, or how are you someone else's mirror? I don't think it's really possible, but it's very moving to me when people seek to identify with someone not of their race or class, but based on emotion and narrative.
Since the 1970s, it seems that when you're looking at feminist thinking, this has been a persistent theme, the idea of the divisions among women and the ways in which some feminist thinkers have relegated people who do not, you know, who don't fit this kind of classic educated mold to the margins. Do you feel as though the 70s, do you feel as though that was a distinctive moment that you would like to see recaptured, just the kind of creativity, the thinking that was happening around and, you know, in Firestone's work and what have you, just trying to draw these connections?
Oh, I just think it was such a marvelous period of deep confusion and energy. I think it was, I don't think the 60s were over in the 70s. I think that the early 70s and to mid 70s were about trying to understand what had the groundwork of the 60s. Imagine, you know, people were having sex freely because of the pill, civil rights. There was just this extraordinary explosion of ideas and bodies. And I think that essentially in the 70s, which is when I grew up, you could still feel that there were these discussions, primarily in the feminist world, about the body and how does that... how do those freedoms manifest themselves in daily life? One of the things I tried to do, and I wasn't so successful, I don't think, in a piece I wrote about Jane Fonda, was to talk about those ideas in terms of the split between black and white feminism and how emotionally Jane was a black feminist passing in the white world. She was able to do a lot for feminists and political causes because of who she was.
What is it that made her a black feminist?
It was her emotional identification with the underclass and her actually adopting a black child who had been part of the Black Panther program. And if you meet her, it's something that you just feel. She feels more comfortable outside of power than in it. And the great dichotomy about her life is, while she's had enormous access to power, it gets fractured in some way. I should rework that piece, because she would have been perhaps really great in White Girls, but it might have been gilding the lily a little bit too much to have Jane in there.
Jane Fonda is also a figure for many number, a familiar figure to many Americans for other reasons as well. For example, for her workout videos. Oh, someone who transitioned from being Hanoi Jane to being someone who is in every American living room on VHS. And I wonder about that moment you describe in the 70s, this moment where some of the sexual experimentation and political experimentation of the 60s became a more pervasive phenomenon. Right. It entered the suburbs. It entered the. It kind of penetrated the society in a much more thoroughgoing kind of way.
Right.
And then
it was part of the national conversation.
But then you have, years later, you seem to have this rewriting of history in which that goes away. So, I mean, these universes, these social worlds in which people were just becoming experimental, they were confused. Suddenly that confusion seemed to have faded away later on. And I wonder, how did that happen? I mean, how did Jane Fonda go from being this kind of radical figure to being someone who is very much a part of this kind of commercial boom, this cult of the body, and these other things that were quite different from what you saw?
I think that she would probably describe her radicalism as continuing through marketing, that one of the things that the reason she did the exercise tapes was to support her husband's, at the time, Tom Hayden's political career. A lot of that money went into supporting his political career. So I remember her telling me that she talked to a black reverend, a radical, and he said that the movement really needed movie stars too, that it was one way to get the message out. And if you look at early tapes of her shows like Dick Cavett, she really doesn't talk about her career as much as she talks about what's happening out there. So I think what we're missing are those risk takers, those people who would be willing to talk about their history vis-a-vis current events. I don't think that there are many people who are that interested in their own history, let alone what's happening now.
When your life during that period, during that post-70s period, did you see yourself and the people you were closest to as part of this little diaspora of people who are still thinking in those 70s terms, surrounded by people who weren't?
No, I don't think so. I think that I've always lived my life with a great deal of hope, and the people that I'm closest to were very hopeful people. I think that AIDS decimated my generation more than any other thing, so the hope that we lived with got pretty wrecked. But again, that spurred another period of intense political activism, which I did not feel part of based on race. It was a largely ACT UP, and those communities were primarily white men. And so coming from where I had come from in Brooklyn, which was a pretty segregated society, I was then confronted less with 70s ferment than I was with the segregation I had grown up with and ideas of the gay community were more romantic in my head than in reality.
As a kind of alternative to the segregated world that you had known in the black community, as something that was in tension with it or in dialogue with it?
I don't think it was so much in... I think that there were attempts to have dialogue with it, but I just think it was actually a replication of plain old segregation. I'm talking about it now because I'm trying to write about it, but it was a world in which dying bodies were the link between gay men, but I don't think that the political activism made black men feel closer to white men. I think that similarly, when the feminist movement became huge in the 70s, there were lots of black women who did not join because they felt they had always been the head of the household. They had always had to be responsible. There was nothing against, they were not fighting against the patriarch. In AIDS activism, the patriarch was the political system that wasn't helping to save gay lives, but they had never stopped to save black lives. So lots of things were canceling each other out.
So when you talk about black feminism, is it fair to say that it wasn't so much, whereas white feminism was about the patriarch and wresting power from the patriarch,
right.
Black feminism was somehow about broader social and political
because
causes?
Because of black American history, black men had been
disempowered in various other ways.
Or not really just not part of the family in that way. And so there was just this feeling that they had, black women had always been the head of the family or kept the family together or the idea of the family. So in a weird way, equating feminism with whiteness didn't really resonate as an activity for a lot of black women that I knew. It felt like an extracurricular activity in some way. That was separate from the business of raising families.
When you're talking about this universe in which you have a category of black man who is operating outside of the family, who is marginal in that sense, I'm curious about its resonances with some of the figures you describe in the book, Louise Brooks, some of the other white women who were similarly marginal. Do you see resonances between those experiences?
Oh, sure. Because one of the things that I love about the people in the book is that there's no longer any pretense for them. By the time they speak to me or I'm writing about them, they're not dealing in the categories that we're talking about now. They're dealing with the sort of struggle and the pain of just being human. So I think when we have a title like White Girls, it's also a riff on titles that identify blackness in the title. So Richard Wright's Black Boy or Toni Morrison's Tar Baby or any number of books that have, James Weldon Johnson's Autobiography of an Ex-Colored Man, any of those books that have titles that presumably identify the story, I wanted to do a title that would not really identify the story.
When you were talking about Jane Fonda a moment ago, I was struck by this idea of marketing as a kind of radicalism. And you'd worked in the fashion world for a very long time. And I wonder about your thinking about that world. Did you see political resonances in the work you were doing and in writing about the world of fashion?
I think so. At that time, we're talking about the early 90s, there was a lot of stuff that was going on that was very interesting in terms of the convergence between fashion and the way and political activity. There was, for instance, a company called the Bernadette Corporation that really was trying to deal with kind of Marxism and style. I think fashion editors like Camilla Nickerson at Vogue was doing a tremendous job at sort of bringing in politics and art in the world of fashion, giving us a context. I think she was brilliant in terms of contextualizing fashion in the everyday, and the everyday is about politics. I think when we were doing Vibe, the first five issues of Vibe that I was involved with, it was very much about how do various styles happen growing out of race or the narrative of difference? How does that inform style? How do we make a sartorial world based on those differences? I thought it was a very exciting time.
So did that feel like a fertile moment, like the 70s in a sense?
Different
from it.
I think different, definitely, but I think equal to that in terms of excitement.
And is that something you see happening again, or do you feel as though we've fallen very far away from that kind of...
Oh, as I said, I'm a deeply hopeful person, so I'm just enormously hopeful that that this will happen, and that the changes that we've discussed in our conversation are ever growing and ever evolving.
When you talk about the world of fashion and style as it intersects with politics, you've talked about people who are very explicitly trying to connect these themes. But I wonder about certain cultural figures, for example, a Michael Jackson, someone who, in their very self-presentation, raises lots of questions. Right. I wonder, I mean, do you see that as political as well, if not deliberately so? Just the way of introducing kind of new styles and sort of new forms of self-presentation, that itself can be something that can enrich and enliven the political conversation?
I see what you're saying, but I think that politics has something to do with self-awareness, not self-denial. And I think that Michael Jackson in particular, in the book, is a study in self-denial, so that his style, you know, his Judy Garland jackets and so on, Diana Ross kind of falsetto, was really sort of based on jettisoning who he was organically in favor of who he wanted to be. I think that real style grows out of a deep desire to express one's individuality without fear. I think he was a fearful person. So I wouldn't use him so much as a figure. I think Andre Leontali is extraordinarily fearless in terms of...
Tell us a bit about her for some of our viewers who might not be familiar
Andre
with her.
Andre Leontali was the style editor, style creative director, I think, of Vogue for a number of years, and he's now running another magazine. But he's a great sort of figure in fashion. He was a protege of Diana Vreeland's, and he worked very closely with Anna Wintour for a number of years. And he's a great figure of style, I think, who's had to be very strong in that world because it's not exactly known for its integration. And one of the things that I've tried to show in my essay about him was the extraordinary amount of grace it takes to survive in that world and to get one's point across, and also to introduce, which is what Andre does as a great reporter, introduce people of color into that world. But it comes at a price, which is a certain amount of alienation and pain, which you read at the end of the piece, caused by a woman friend of his. But I have nothing but respect for him and his, I think, enormous grace in a world that sometimes does not recognize that in him.
When you talk about expressing individuality, I wonder, for you as a writer and as your writing has evolved over time, is that something that has always been a preoccupation, or is that something that as you gained freedom, as you built a reputation as a writer, that's something that you've been able to do more of?
I think that I've always been a contrary person, so I've always tried to do what I feel writing allows us to do, which is self-expression. And however that came out was going to be me. That took many years to understand, that there was no filter between self-expression and what was on the page. And so I think that the rest of my life I'll be spending trying to understand that immediate feeling and to convey to other people that immediate feeling of this is who I am and this is who I want to talk about, and this is the way I see it.
I had a conversation with a German friend recently. I'd referred to someone as a friend, someone I hadn't known for very long. And she was, surprised by it, and she just talked about how, you know, among Germans, to characterize someone as a friend
is a very serious thing.
It's a very serious thing. It speaks to a level of shared history and intimacy.
Yes.
Whereas I think for many Americans, myself included, you know, the idea of a friend, I mean, there's a broad universe.
It's much more casual.
It's more expansive. It certainly includes people with whom you have this kind of very strong kind of intimacy, and others, you know, who are more casual acquaintances. And friendship seems to have been an incredibly important part of your life,
partly because
friendship has blurred into other kinds of relationship. Friendship has, you know, been incredibly central to your self-definition. And I wonder, do you use the term friendship to refer to, you know, kind of casual acquaintances, or are you very?
No, I'm very. I think maybe I was German in another life because I take it very seriously. I think it's been more consistent than lover, let's say. Friend is a deep commitment for as many years as we can take it. So no, I don't use it very lightly at all. I don't have that many, and the ones I have, dead and alive, I cherish deeply.
The first essay in your book concerns, you mentioned one friend, a Latvian woman. Yet there was another friend as well.
Yes.
And I wonder if you could just tell us a bit about, given that friendship has come to mean a lot to you, and it sounds though you expect a lot of your friends and you also give a great deal to your friends.
Yes.
When were the first friendships in your life? I mean, did you form them, you know, as a child, or was it only when you had a stronger sense of yourself that you were able to form friendships of that kind of durability and strength?
I think that I was always interested in connecting to other people. We had a next-door neighbor named Teresa, who was a friend of my sister's, and I just adored her, and she's one of the first people to take me into the city, capital T and A C. And I loved anyone who showed me the world, or a larger part of the world, and I was always interested in diversity. And so I just adored her, and I always fall in love with friends.
Because she shared the wider world with you, and you saw that as an act of generosity.
And I also I always fall in love with people who are willing to show me something, who can take me by the hand and say, look at this. I think it's the greatest act of friendship I know is to expose someone to something that they didn't know about.
Including some other perspective. It could be an experience that you guys, something that is familiar to you both, but to kind of see it through a different lens
is
also very powerful.
And yes, because then you're seeing the world through someone else's eyes, and that person's eyes love you. So they're not only reflecting something new, they're reflecting love.
Now, given the what you saw as the depth of this generosity, you know, I assume you had an impulse to want to return something. And what was that in the case of these early friendships, the people who gave you something by exposing you to the wider world? Was it your self-exposure? Was it that you were kind of sharing your perspective and insight? Or was there something else that you wanted to give them?
I don't think it was so conscious on my part.
Transactional.
It was definitely an exchange, but it didn't feel like a commodity in some way. It felt like trust. I guess that's the word. And when you have trust with another person, or when I do, the feeling is limitless of wanting to share and to give. For me, anyway.
There's a Morrissey song called "Hold On to Your Friends." Have you ever heard this song?
No, but I love him. What does he say?
So the song, it's the lyrics are, you know, but now you only call me when you're feeling depressed.
Right.
When you feel happy, I'm so far from your mind. My patience is stretched. My loyalty vexed. You're losing all of your friends.
No.
So it's a.
Well, that's a pretty self-absorbed friend, and I've had some of those too, and mostly. Mostly our self-absorbed friends show their true colors when they fall in love with someone. That's always a drag. But I tend not to really stay in relationships with people when the friendship is convenient for them. I like to be in it for the long haul and for all the complications.
Yet some of the central friendships of your life have been with people who really were incredibly loyal to you for a very long period of time.
Yes,
and yet,
I'm very lucky.
Yet eventually that friendship was kind of withdrawn when a relationship intervened or something like that.
Yes, that is true.
And
that's very painful.
That must, I wonder, because, I mean, your expectation must have been given that the friendship had endured for such a long period of time, that surely it was robust enough to...
I think that that's a romantic expectation on my part that I need to minimize, because I feel that all we have is each other, that it will go on. But sometimes people can't do it. And it's a very sad thing to have to face, that we are all made up of limitations, and that one of the great things about having grown up somewhat is understanding that there was nothing I could do to change their feelings or their limitations, let alone my own.
Can the friendship change? Can it move from one form that involves such a degree of devotion and energy and intimacy to another form, or do you think that it's really one or the other?
I used to be a one or the other kind of guy, but I think that I'm, in my decrepitude, beginning to understand that it can evolve and change into something else.
As a critic, I wonder, are there writers who have felt like friends to you, people that you haven't known, people who have been long dead, but who through your work you've connected to in that kind of a way and you've returned to again and again?
Oh, yes. I love so many people.
Flannery O'Connor is someone you talk about
in the book,
with great affection and interest.
Truman Capote, too. I think that he was a figure in terms of gay culture that was so profound and important.
What was it about Truman Capote that makes him an important figure in gay culture, given that, you know, he was not someone who openly identified as such? I mean,
because he was just so transparent in his transgression of what, quote-unquote, maleness was supposed to be. At that time, a lot of people were aspiring to be Hemingway, even if they were women. And I think that his transgression had a lot to do with his hyper... swishiness and outrageous kind of defiance of the norm. He's a hero of mine in that way. That's kind of life as politics for me. Let's see, other writers that I adore. I learned a lot about Proust in terms of mixing up genres, fiction, essay, and so on. Jane Bowles is a big hero. I don't know how to write about her because she's so unique. Jean Rhys, I'm thinking about James Baldwin.
Many of these writers are writers of fiction, and I wonder how you see your career unfolding, because one thing that's certainly true is that you seem, you know, quite fearless and quite willing to kind of bare your soul in your writing. Yet I wonder if, and you talk about mixing these genres, but do you see yourself moving in a direction in which the kind of fictional element and fictional scenarios will become more central to your writing?
I think so. What do you think?
I think that would make a lot of sense.
Yeah, I think in some deep way, if I could manage a career writing criticism and fiction, I would be happy. But it's been, we go to this idea of evolution. It's been an evolution for me. I didn't wake up one day and say I want to be a novelist. I just woke up as myself every day subconsciously working towards other ways of writing. I love working at The New Yorker because I'm given a great deal of freedom to think. And I like fiction because then I don't have to interview anybody. I can just sit there and listen to voices.
You know, when you invoke your childhood in segregated Brooklyn, yet now you're a part of some of our most celebrated, august institutions invested with tremendous cultural authority. How do you feel about that?
Oh, I don't think I have any particular feeling about it. I feel fortunate, I think. I don't really sort of look at the past and weigh it in connection to the present or the future. I think I look at the past to understand context, and I never think of myself or my narrative as being a narrative that I'm following. It's just the stuff that happened. So I think that my mother, who's no longer with us, would have been a more precise person for you to ask that question of, because she would have seen the story in a different way. But for me, it's just really been about writing and how writing can get you from A to B to Z in terms of thinking. So the writing has always come first, and the trappings are very nice. But I think that the writing comes first.
Now, I understand that while your book is a collection of writings, you think it ought to be read as a whole. And tell us a bit about that, about what strands kind of draw it together.
Well, I hope it's being read as a whole. If you think about great books like William Faulkner's Go Down Moses, which was a series, 7 short stories, and he asked that it be read as a novel. I think to understand the emotional velocity of the book sometimes can be confusing if it's cut up into different sections. But I don't want the reader to feel that that should stop them in between reading. I think that the characters feel very novelistic to me, and so that's what I was asking for.
Hilton, thanks very much for joining us. I really appreciate your
time. Oh, gosh, thank you for having me.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.